we're talking about the four foundations and how the Buddha taught these first and how deep they are. And a quote from Gil Fronsdal, the Four Noble Truths are the core essence of Buddhism, not the lowest common denominator, but the highest common denominator. Only someone who's fully awakened, completely understand the full import of the Four Noble Truths. So we're going to experiment with not using the English word for a little bit to help us understand what it is better. Because the English word can kind of get in the way. Because people go, oh, that's what it is. And then that limits. So let's try not using the English word. We'll just use this dukkha word for a while. I'll bring up the English word at the end. And most of you already know it. But there's supposedly three layers of dukkha. Three layers of dukkha. But let's focus on the subtlest one, was this pervasive dukkha of conditioning. And this has lots of facets. But you could say that the problem with conditioned existence is that none of it's under our control. Factors are happening out there, and we can't influence, we can influence maybe, but things happen. And the more we understand that, the more we realize that we are existing in this great sequence of intercausality, of things arising from other things. And even all of our life conditions, even our whole sense of self, are all parts of this big web of interdependence, which is fine. That's just how it is. But if we think that we can gain satisfaction somewhere by being in a specific condition, we're kind of foiled because we don't have control over that. And things are changing in ways that sometimes are obvious and often are not. You know, what causes change to happen can be a big surprise. So our outer conditions are interdependent or dependently arisen. You know, perhaps we'd like to be, I don't know, healthy, attractive, strong, and confident. And I'm sure once in a while that happens for all of us. But then we can't stop the inevitable aging of our bodies or any frailty that arises from that or death. Not to imagine just the curveballs of circumstance that come at us, you know. Accidents are never expected, and falls and illness and all that physical stuff. And then in terms of our inner universe, our sense of self, it's even more slippery. I mean, we all know, you know, look at what happens in meditation, where all these thoughts and memories and planning and fears and desires and comparing and regretting just arises and passes all by itself. I mean, sometimes it's just, you ever sit there and just go, that is so marvelous. That all this stuff is just coming and going and coming and going. I don't have any control at all. In the second sermon, the Buddha, he points this out in a number of places in the suttas, how we're not in control of our minds. It's that we are not our minds just because things arise unbidden. He goes through all the five skandhas, but at the end he says, bhikkhus, consciousness is not self. Were consciousness self, then this consciousness would not lead to affliction. And one could have it of consciousness, let my consciousness be that, thus. Let my consciousness be not thus. We could control it as we wished, if it was ourself. But since consciousness is not self, so it leads to affliction. And none can have it of consciousness, let my consciousness be thus. Let my consciousness be not thus. And he talks also about body, all five skandhas. I always thought that's really amazing. You know, it really cuts to the quick right there. That he's saying you can't control it. And if it was ourself, we could, but since we can't, it must not be ourself. Because it's doing what it's going to do. So we can't depend on circumstances to be favorable, and we can't hinge our well-being unfavorable circumstances, because if we try to do that, it ain't gonna work, and that's a difficulty. And even on the subtlest levels of our self-identity, like who am I, you know, our sense of self, there's nothing dependable there either, because A, there isn't any self, but we start to see it in a different way, and all these phenomena that the parts that we make self of, they just arise and pass, and there's prior causes and conditions, and you know, we can find ourselves in a state of mind we have no idea where it came from, and we'll do something and why did I just do that, just like, it's like you got a bunch of squirrels inside doing all these funny things. So there's free will, but it's also, but that's kind of a bit player in the middle of all this conditionality. So really starting to get our heads into this nature of dukkha, the way we can't depend on conditions for happiness, is really a doorway to awakening. Because in our culture, as we all know, there's like 100 million billion messages. And actually, I did this exercise last night. I looked back to see when the first Sears Roebuck catalog, that was like the Amazon of the early 20s. It was. You know, they used to be like 300 pages, and they would arrive on your doorstep out in your farm in the middle of Nebraska, and you could order whatever you wanted. But before about like 1908 or something, 1910, there wasn't any such thing. It's almost like the beginning of consumerism as we have it. There just wasn't any such thing. You know, people made what they did pretty much. We have this idea. I mean, store-bought has become a hackneyed term, but it arose when there was an alternative, you know, when it was getting so obvious you could buy stuff. So in one century, basically, and a little more, we've created this huge miasma of consumerism, convincing us that we can get the right conditions to be happy. And that'll work somehow. But of course, we know it doesn't work. But that's really like 100 years in the entire history of humanity is short. And so the more we really cut through that and realize that that's an illusion, then the closer we are to the solution. We're not hornswoggled by it, which is a technical Sanskrit term. Sorry. But we're freed. You know, the more we can see through it and not get lost there. And it's pretty cool to be able to go, oh, yeah. I'm a little bit of a, I will self-admit, I'm a little bit of a motorhead to my embarrassment. I use way too many memories, cells. And so Google now knows that I'm interested in fast cars. And there's like this insane, like people are like building hypercars all over the world, these new hypercars that cost $2 million, you know, for crazy cars that can go 270 miles an hour and they're competing against each other. And it's just like, oh my God, you know, here in the early 21st century with climate change coming and people are doing that, and it's because of grasping. Some person is going to think that $2 million is going to bring them satisfaction, I guess. So seeing through this is just amazing. Started this first noble truth, the more we can really bring it home, it really does help us move ahead on the path. The more we realize the problem, the more awake we are and the closer to freedom. So I promise the English translation, most of you know it, it's often translated as suffering, which has all kinds of emotional connotations that just don't help. It kind of diverts us from this deeper level, or unsatisfactoriness, which is better. But maybe this is clear, that the first noble truth, because a lot of people, they look at suffering, you know, like I've seen criticisms from, I don't know, the Pope or something. They look at suffering and they say, oh, what a gloomy negative sort of tradition this is. But it's not. It's just pointing out where we get stuck, which is the starting point for freedom. So it's not a gloomy interpretation of life. It's just a clear understanding. I refer to it as the difficult reality of unawakened existence. Robert Thurman, I love what he says. He's, as some of you may know, he's an author, professor at Columbia of Buddhism, former Buddhist monk, and Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he says, the Buddha didn't really say that all life is suffering. He said that unenlightened life is suffering. And it's a beautiful way. I've always really liked that. It's a beautiful way of looking at it. Unenlightened life is suffering. That's why we're on the path to not be unenlightened. Then we won't suffer. The Buddha didn't suffer in pain, but he didn't suffer because he was awakened. So this kind of shows us a way forward and helps us clarify that dukkha is not inherent in existence. It's inherent in our relationship to it, to the degree to which we're awake or not. If we're lost in it, then we suffer. If we can see phenomena but not be lost in them, then we're free. And in between those is the path. So back to the doctor metaphor,
Wait, can you repeat that? That was beautiful. You said it's not inherent in existence, but.
I repeat it? I don't know if I would. I just said it. Listen to
It's
the.
recorded.
Yeah. But it's not inherent in existence. It's about our relationship with existence. Yeah. And that we can change that. That's between being lost in it and being a Buddha, is where most of us are. But we're on the path toward freedom. So it shows us a way forward. And back to the doctor metaphor. So maybe now we have some sense of the illness, this dukkha, that arises from an unenlightened relationship with the undependability of conditions. But the message is that the Buddha never said, he never said that we don't suffer when we get conditions to line up pleasantly. It's not the goal to get things to be nice and then we won't suffer. But rather, when we awaken, we don't suffer, irrespective of the conditions. And put another way, so pain is not the issue. Dukkha is. We can experience pain and not suffer, not experience dukkha. And that's amazing, because we all think in our culture that experience, pain and suffering. People say pain and suffering one word, like it's the same. It's not the same thing. We can experience pain and not suffer. That's part of the beauty of this. I think I've said before, but one of my teachers said, this practice has to work when you're in an ICU with tubes sticking out of you. And yeah. And I know people that have done some incredible stuff with really being able to work with severe pain from medical circumstance because they have really deep practice and not suffering. When the 16th Karmapa died of cancer in a hospital in Indiana in a situation which, medically speaking, he must have been in a whole bunch of pain. And no one could tell because he was just like radiating compassion at everybody. I remember I read about this. The people in the hospital were just like agog because he wasn't suffering. He's a highly, highly awakened being. So pain is not the issue. Dukkha is. Sometimes the Buddha calls dukkha the second arrow, clarifying that this dukkha is not about whether a circumstance is pleasant or unpleasant, but about how we relate to whatever the circumstance is. And then we're shifting here to the second, sort of transitioning into the second noble truth. Because the key words here are what causes the problem. The issue is what causes this problem of suffering. And key words in Pali are clinging, upadana, and thirst, often called also well, hunger, thirst, grasping, wanting. But thirst is, I think it's actually Pali, panha is actually translated as thirst in Pali. And it's a great word because it really has this sense of how we want and we cling. Those are two separate things that interact, but that's what we do on the wanting side, and the aversion side is the opposite. We thirst.
Is thirst then more like desire
Yeah,
in
it
that
is.
sense?
Yeah, it's desire. But thirst is great because it has this kind of, you can almost, desire has all kinds of, like, the English word has all these emotional connotations, sexual connotations, whatever. But thirst is like, it's this powerful thing, probably in the Sudan. There's a lot of that, right? Yeah. And the Buddha says, here's a quote here, "Now this bhikkhus, this monastics, is a noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to rebecoming, accompanied by delight and lust. Seeking delight here and there, that is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, craving for disbecoming." I'm trying to figure what that part means, I will humbly admit. But we crave for becoming, we crave for pleasures, and we crave for satisfaction. And if we try to, posit our well-being on that being satisfied, it ain't going to work. You know how the world is. And often, we sort of get little hints how rich people often seem to have all kinds of convoluted suffering, and celebrities just are a train wreck usually. And it's because they've, I can imagine, I mean, all of their position and everything, it must be so hard. I actually had a little revelation about that myself. Some of you know my brother has been in politics. So he's been in elected office in New York for, I figured out, 18 years. 18 years, and he was mayor for four in New York City, and ran for Congress, and just dropped out 2 days ago, because it just wasn't going to work. And I was struck how, I know he's just, I was all disappointed. It's like, oh my God, that's crazy. I realized that on some level, I felt this sense of identity or power or connection because of being, my brother being mayor of New York, you know? And so it was really sort of embarrassing, but it was helpful, helpful to see that. And we all have places like that, right? Where we kind of ride on something and kind of puff ourselves up a little bit. But the Buddha had, you know, when you really think about his life, there was nothing fun. I mean, in the sense that he had no horse, no chariot, no land, no armies. He was very Spartan, a set of robes, the food he was offering, sleeping just where he was. But he was free. He was happy. And these monks that I was with on Tuesday, I mean, they are very strict interpretation of the Vinaya. So they, you know, they only take the food that's offered. They can't ask for anything but water. They can't keep any food after noon. So they have to eat it by noon and then give it to someone. And it's pretty amazing. And if no one gives them food, then they don't eat that day. It's just, it's astonishing. And it's this real, and they're just a sense of letting go. There's such this powerful letting go. They just roll with it. When talking about the monastic path, the Buddha said, "The household life is confined and dusty. Going forth from it is freeing. It is not easy for one who lives in the home to live the holy life, perfectly complete, perfectly pure and polished, like a conch shell." Now, we're not talking about being monastics, but that helps us. I find that's a real helpful metaphor to see how we can live in our home situations. And you know, I think about that a lot. Because how do we be in that circumstance and try to make it pure and polished like a conch shell, so we're not sticky, you know, so we don't suffer, so the clinging doesn't happen? How can we navigate that with what we got to do? So we're not monastics, but the key difference is this clinging, this hunger for pleasant circumstance that drives so much of human existence. And you know, sometimes goes fine and we're happy, and we want more of that, and we don't like what happens, and the pleasant, unpleasant happens, and we wished it would stop. And our relationship with that is real important. And pain, you know, broken foot, broken heart, but if we can hold it in mindfulness, bring that, a lot of discussion, interesting discussion today about what can be the place you're being mindful of. And it might, in fact, just be pain from a broken foot or a broken heart. And that may be the thing that we have to bring into our practice. Maybe we can't even find our breath because the pain is so strong. But that's the place where we can find freedom incrementally, right in the middle of the pain. Buddha experienced pain, but he didn't suffer. He didn't cling. He didn't want pleasant instead of unpleasant. There's this beautiful, I know I've read this to a few people at times, but there's a sutta, Samyutta Nikaya 1.38, a stone splinter. And it says, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajaga in the something, Deer Park. Now on that occasion, the Blessed One's foot had been cut by a stone splinter. Severe pains assailed the Blessed One. Bodily feelings that were painful, racking, sharp, piercing, harrowing, disagreeable. But the Blessed One endured them, mindful and clearly comprehending without becoming distressed. Then the Blessed One had his outer robe folded in four, and he lay down on his right side in the lion posture with one leg overlapping the other, mindful and clearly comprehending. You know, so right in the middle of that, mindful and clearly comprehending. And that particular situation was exacerbated because the reason why he had stone splinters was because his evil cousin Devadatta had tried to kill him by rolling a boulder onto him, and the boulder had shattered and a stone splinter entered his foot. So he had family problems too. But he was mindful and clearly comprehending. So, you know, it is powerful. Because this is really driving us towards understanding the second noble truth. Because we do experience pain, and we fear pain because we think pain will make us suffer. We think that they're inherently linked. And so we do our best to avoid pain and to find pleasant stuff. But it doesn't have to be that. We truly understand that pain isn't the issue. Unpleasant isn't the issue. The real issue is grasping an aversion, our relationship to pain. Then we can learn to hold it differently. And pain's going to happen sometime. But we won't suffer. You know, for us, it's probably we won't suffer so much. But over time, it starts to get deeper. I know you've talked about that a lot, some stuff you've been through, yeah. And finding freedom in the middle of really hard conditions. And a side note to this, in terms of a mindful practice, is if you ever wondered what the second foundation of mindfulness, what's that about, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral? It sounds like this sort of funny little odd thing the Buddha stuck in there. That's what it's about. This is why it's so important. Because to be mindful of pleasant and unpleasant when it happens, that's how we're not lost in it. That's how we can start to connect with this second noble truth of the cause of suffering. If we can be mindful of unpleasant and go, unpleasant, 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 and not be adhered to it, that's amazing. It's amazing. So that's why it is the Vedanas. Vedanas comes up here, which is a name for pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And also it's the second of the five skandhas, which makes up our sense of self. So it's a really important aspect in Buddha Dharma. And it's because it lands right here in terms of what happens in the second noble truth, the whole question of the cause of suffering. So we'll be talking about this more next time in terms of the way out. But this then is the first two, the problem and the cause of the problem, dukkha and the cause of dukkha. And the solution is in our practice, in our understanding. So let's sit for a moment.